The subcommittee on, good Lord, guys, sorry. Let's tone it down for staff if we can not have my booming voice. The Subcommittee on Intelligence and Counterterrorism will come to order. Subcommittee is meeting today on terrorism and digital financing, how technology is changing the threat. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare the subcommittee in recess at any point. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank our witnesses from the Department of Homeland Security for being here today to discuss a topic that I think is really timely and really interesting, which is how digital financial tools can be exploited by terrorist actors to funnel support for their activities. Over the past several months, the abuse of digital finance platforms and technologies has jumped into the public view as the result of the burst of ransomware attacks that has struck the heart of day-to-day life in America, from gas pipelines and meat processing plants to schools and hospitals. Last month, just as an anecdote, I held an event in my district with the Secretary of Agriculture focused on small family farms. This was just days after the ransomware attack on the world's largest meat processor. I'm in a room full of farmers. We're in a barn. There's the John Deere tractors behind us. And when we opened it up to Q&A, the first question from the farmers was about cyber attacks, cryptocurrency, and asking what their government was doing to protect them. Now, let's be clear, there is nothing inherently illicit or illegal about cryptocurrencies or other digital finance technologies. They're used by millions of law-abiding people every single day. Nor is there anything inherently suspect about using technologies that aim to protect the privacy of users. But it's our responsibility on this committee to also understand how these tools could enable malicious activity that threatens our homeland security, whether it's a ransomware attack like the one I discussed with those farmers, or our topic today, funding for terrorism. Detecting and preventing terrorist funding at home or abroad has long been a cat and mouse game for the federal investigators and the intelligence community. Just like cyber criminals, terrorists consistently seek legal loopholes, illegal pathways, and new tech to stay one step ahead of governments, especially when it comes to funding their operations. As a former CIA analyst, I know this is far from a new challenge. We've been tracking terrorist financing for decades, and I know firsthand how difficult it can be. While the technology has changed, today's terrorists and extremist groups benefit from using many of the same tools that so many of us rely on for our daily honest activities, just as they exploited commonly used financial systems in the past. Some of the online platforms and online tech allow easy access for thousands, if not millions, of users to donate money through online campaigns. For example, crowdfunding through PayPal, GoFundMe, and Amazon have become popular ways in recent years for extremist groups to raise money. Bitcoin has been the currency of choice for ransomware and terrorist actors. To put this in context, according to the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, from about 2005 to 2015, just about every extremist group they tracked featured a PayPal button on their website. Now, even though PayPal and other payment processing platforms became aware of the issue, began to ban extremists from their platforms, which is a great first step, these groups have persevered and maintained a strong online presence. So beyond social media platforms, new tech like cryptocurrencies, which are decentralized, largely anonymous forms of digital money, have enabled terrorists to further expand and disguise their funding efforts. Think about, for many of us who were sort of in the 9/11 era, the hawalas that we all became familiar with after 9/11, except now the currency is virtual instead of being filtered through couriers. As these technologies become more and more widely used, we've seen a number of incidents in the past year that highlight the need for the federal government to understand these technologies to the degree to which they pose a threat and their impact on terrorist financing. There's a number of examples from recent days, I'm sure you all be talking about them. But just as nefarious groups have changed their fundraising tactics after crackdowns by payment processors like PayPal, when law enforcement begins following and cracking down on illicit Bitcoin use, terrorist fundraisers advise supporters to use other cryptocurrencies to avoid detection. This was the case of a pro-ISIS website that requested did its supporters send money via Monero, another cryptocurrency, instead of Bitcoin because of its privacy and safety features. So we just need to properly understand and combat this threat. And we know that it requires a lot of partnership between the private sector, our allies and partners, and of course, a task the Department of Homeland Security is well positioned to lead. I will just end by saying today, I'm hoping our witnesses will help us understand the actual scope and scale of this challenge. How much money are we talking about? How does it compare to terrorist financing as a whole, or the total amount of cryptocurrency transactions? And who's taking advantage of this new tool? Is it domestic or foreign groups? Just help us contextualize a little bit. We know we have an uphill battle. Our subcommittee stands ready to help the department with what you need. If you need changes to legislation, if you need resources, we want to hear more from you, not less. So we're pleased to welcome our witnesses today. I will just note that, as I mentioned to the witnesses, we expect votes to be called probably in the next 10 minutes. We will try and keep the hearing going as long as possible. There'll probably be a short gap when myself and Mr. Malinowski are voting, but we will try to tag team to make it as minimal as possible. So I now recognize the ranking member of the subcommittee, the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Pfluger, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you holding this hearing today, and I'd like to thank the witnesses as well. Assistant Director Jeremy Sheridan from the Office of Investigations at the Secret Service, Assistant Director John Isert from Investigative Programs at HSI, and Acting Deputy Undersecretary Stephanie Dobich from the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. I appreciate your expertise and your willingness to speak with us today on this very important subject, and I'm looking forward to an informative and productive discussion on this very important topic. And I think this hearing is especially timely right now, with American troops in effect fully withdrawn from Afghanistan and the Taliban rapidly taking control of Afghanistan's provincial districts, reportedly occupying about a third of the country and including the key border crossing areas. Afghan security forces are surrendering. The Taliban is beginning to fight for some of the provincial cities. And there's public reporting that Afghan government could collapse at some point as soon as maybe even 6 months. But I think the point is all that to say that foreign terrorist organizations are alive and well. And not only are they present overseas, but they're growing. And as we know, Afghanistan is only a portion of the widespread and diverse terror threat landscape that we face around the world. If they are given the opportunity to cement their presence overseas, I have no doubt that their next goal is and will continue to be to launch an attack on U.S. soil or on those of our partners and allies. Those who've served in Afghanistan saw firsthand the death and destruction that terrorist organizations can cause and have caused. And it's absolutely imperative that the war on terror be fought abroad on foreign soil, not here at home. We must guarantee that foreign terrorist organizations do not have the resources to expand their operations and bring the fight to the United States, to our homeland. Cutting off their access to financing is absolutely critical. It is paramount in this fight. And terrorist financing is not a new issue. Whether a transnational criminal organization, a foreign terrorist organization, or money launderer, we have been confronting this problem for decades. But cryptocurrency is, in fact, becoming a new tool that terrorists and other criminal enterprises have at their disposal. Unfortunately, Congress has not always been known for our ability to stay one step ahead when it comes to the latest technological advances. But when we're confronting the issue of terrorism and financing, playing catch-up is not an option for us. During a conversation I had earlier this week with Assistant Director Sheridan and Assistant Director Isert, they mentioned that relative to terrorist financing, to the terrorist financing world, that cryptocurrency and the transactions account for maybe 1% of all cases. And I think that this tells me right now that we are having this hearing at exactly the right time, that we might have a chance to stay one step ahead of what the issues and the problems could be before this becomes a systemic issue worldwide. And we're now in a position to provide our agency partners with the resources and the authorities that they need to confront this proactively instead of reacting to it. That is why I'm most looking forward to the hearing about the hearing today, and how do we ensure that cryptocurrency transactions continue to be at least 1% or maybe even less of the problem? And what does DHS need from us in Congress to best situate themselves to combat this threat? And coming out of this hearing, I also hope to understand what we should expect going forward. Although this is a small portion of the problem now, do we foresee that changing? If it is suspected to grow, how much will it grow, and how can we minimize that growth? It's been almost 20 years since 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists coordinated the hijacking of four commercial airlines, flying them into buildings which were recognized worldwide as symbols of American strength, of freedom, of accomplishment, and taking 2,977 innocent lives. Thus far, we have successfully prevented an attack of that magnitude that we experienced on September 11th. And as long as I serve my country, and I think the chairwoman would also agree, whether it's in uniform overseas or in the capacity that we now serve here in Congress, I will do everything, and I think I can confidently say we will do everything in our power to ensure that what happened on 9/11 does not happen again. And I'm confident that my fellow members on the Homeland Security Committee also feel the same way in a very bipartisan manner. I'm looking forward to working with Chairwoman Slotkin and the other members of this committee to ensure that we are providing the department with all the tools necessary to minimize the threat caused by terrorist financing and to successfully protect our homeland. Once again, I'd like to thank our witnesses for joining us today, for your expertise, for your service to this country, and for looking at a threat in a proactive way that we can combat now so that it doesn't continue to become a problem of larger magnitude. And with that, Madam Chair, I yield back.
I now welcome our panel of witnesses. Our first witness is Ms. Stephanie Dobish, the Deputy Undersecretary for Intelligence Enterprise Operations at DHS. Our second witness is Mr. John Isert, the Assistant Director of Investigative Programs at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Homeland Security Investigations, HSI. And our third and final witness is Mr. Jeremy Sheridan, the Assistant Director of the Office of Investigations at the U.S. Secret Service. Without objection, the witness's full statements will be inserted into the record. I now ask each witness to summarize his or her statement for 5 minutes, beginning with Deputy Undersecretary Dobish.
Good morning, Chairman Slotkin, Ranking Member Pfluger, members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to represent the Office of Intelligence and Analysis and to discuss the malicious use of crypto and other digital currencies. Over the last several years, INA has observed a growing and concerning trend of a wide range of malicious actors seeking to use access to digital and cryptocurrencies to facilitate their activities. This includes domestic and international terrorists, nation-state adversaries, transnational and other criminal organizations, and cyber criminals. While the intent and capabilities of these actors vary widely, INA assesses that all of them see using crypto and other digital currencies as an effective means to obfuscate and fund their operations, including against the United States. Cryptocurrencies are a digital or virtual currency that is secured by cryptography, or in other words, sophisticated coding. They are not issued by any central authority, and they offer users a high degree of anonymity, complicating law enforcement and intelligence community efforts to identify and disrupt potentially threatening activity. Bitcoin is the market leader, but there are thousands of other cryptocurrencies, including currency known as privacy coins, which provide an even greater level of obscurity for malicious actors. This means that users can easily hide who is sending or receiving a transaction, transaction amounts, and individual units of currency. Since at least 2015, we have observed terrorists seeking to use cryptocurrencies to procure materials and solicit funding for their operations. Most of this activity has occurred by terrorist groups and associates overseas, spanning the ideological spectrum. For example, supporters of ISIS and Al-Qaeda have solicited cryptocurrency donations. And earlier this year, a pro-Al-Qaeda media group offered a reward of one Bitcoin, worth about $60,000 at the time, to the first person to kill a police officer in a Western country. We've also seen foreign, racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists claim that their activities were supported by the use of cryptocurrencies. In 2019, Brenton Tarrant, the perpetrator of the mosque attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand, claimed in his manifesto to have made money dealing in cryptocurrency. Later that same year, a racially or ethnically motivated violent extremist who attempted an attack in a synagogue in Germany claimed he received financial support for his operation via cryptocurrency. Beyond terrorism, the use of cryptocurrency has become even more common among cyber actors and criminal organizations. North Korean cyber actors affiliated with the regime have executed lucrative cryptocurrency thefts valued at hundreds of millions of dollars. Cryptocurrency is increasingly being used to buy and sell drugs on the dark web and by drug cartels seeking to launder their drug profits. And cryptocurrency is becoming the payment of choice for cyber criminals who are conducting ransomware attacks or selling malicious cyber services online. It is important to remember that the illicit use of cryptocurrency is a small fraction of the global transactions that occur daily. And many malicious actors, particularly foreign terrorist groups, are still relying on traditional means of funding. However, as this technology becomes more accessible and more scrutiny is applied to traditional banking systems, we expect to see more activity, and our ability to detect and disrupt these threat actors will be even more difficult. INA's mandate and core mission is to provide federal, state, local, tribal, territorial, and private sector partners with the intelligence and information necessary to secure the homeland. And I want to underscore that INA is committed to strengthening our efforts to identify and communicate the plans and intentions of malicious actors seeking to exploit emerging technologies like cryptocurrency. Just this week, INA hosted our partners from the State and Local Intelligence Council for a conference where this topic was discussed as a significant intelligence gap in our intelligence. Like with any threat to the homeland, INA will ensure that policy and operational decision makers have the most robust understanding of this threat that the intelligence community can provide. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss this issue and for your continued support to the Office of Intelligence and Analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Dobish. I now recognize Assistant Director Iser to summarize his statement for 5 minutes. And my sense is we may break just after Mr. Iser for a few moments while we go and vote.
Thank you, Chairwoman Slotkin, Ranking Member Pfluger, and distinguished members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss the critical investigative role Homeland Security Investigation plays in the fight to protect the homeland from transnational crime and threats. My testimony today will focus on HSI's efforts to identify, investigate, and bring to justice criminal organizations and terrorist networks whose illicit use of cryptocurrency jeopardizes national security and public safety. As a principal investigative component of the Department of Homeland Security, HSI is a global law enforcement organization responsible for conducting criminal investigations into the legal cross-border movement of goods, money, contraband, people, and technology into, out of, and throughout the United States. HSI strives to protect the homeland's digital borders and pursue malicious cyber actors with the same dedication that we safeguard our physical land and sea borders. HSI applies its unique authorities and capabilities to conduct investigations, which include combating financial crime, investigating cybercrime, and protecting national security. The illicit use of cryptocurrency by nefarious actors relates to each of these priorities. Cryptocurrency is a digital asset that works as a medium of exchange or a store of value and is often used for purchase illicit items such as drugs or guns on the darknet marketplaces, to launder criminally derived proceeds, or as a means to provide material support to terrorist organizations. Traditional money laundering methods remain, yet cryptocurrency can now be used with relative ease to facilitate any type of illicit activity. Given that cryptocurrency is utilized across the spectrum of crimes that HSI has the authority to investigate, HSI plays a critical role in the U.S. government's efforts to detect, investigate, and prevent its illicit use. As such, HSI investigations related to cryptocurrency have risen from a single criminal investigation in 2011 to over 604 active criminal investigations and $80 million in cryptocurrency seizures in this year alone. This marked increase signifies growing confidence in cryptocurrency by bad actors, but also HSI's technical proficiency in performing these complex investigations. To be successful, HSI recognizes the importance of enhanced public and private partnerships. With that, we continue to be forward-leaning in our approach to Operation Cornerstone, our outreach efforts. Since 2019, HSI has provided 660 presentations to over 61,000 attendees with the primary focus of detecting and closing vulnerabilities in the financial, trade, and transportation sectors. With the rapid growth of virtual currency, HSI expanded our outreach to include private industries involved in the cryptocurrency space, conducting 116 presentations to over 5,000 participants. The relationship we build with private sector directly correlates to our investigative success. They are not mutually exclusive. Last year, HSI led a global cyber operation with IRS and the FBI related to 24 cryptocurrency accounts, all of which were identified as sources of influence for Al-Qaeda. The HSI undercover operation was initiated to investigate the unlawful use of cryptocurrency to support terrorism. The result of the investigation HSI seized 60 virtual currency wallets worth $80 million and illuminated the illicit financial network. In another case, HSI initiated another cyber undercover operation that resulted in the seizure of 150 cryptocurrency accounts worth $2 million and the taking over a Hamas-administered website that solicited funds for jihad. HSI covertly operated the site, embedding an HSI undercover wallet and email to track funds and communications. The results of these cases and others illustrate how law enforcement can effectively disrupt terrorist groups through the use of HSI's financial and global investigative authorities, technical aptitude, undercover authorities, and the ability to use private sector as a force multiplier to disrupt and dismantle the command and control structure of these criminal organizations. In closing, I appreciate your interest in this rapidly growing field. Thank you again for the opportunity to be before you today and your continued support of Homeland Security Investigations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Pursuant to today's order, the subcommittee stands in recess, subject to the call of the chair. Mr. Malinowski will be back shortly, and I will flag that we have a couple of members who are online. You can't see them, but when they are called for questions, they will come up and you'll be aware of them. So give us just a few minutes. We'll be right back to you. Assistant Director Sheridan to summarize his statement for 5 minutes.
Can you hear me, ma'am? I have a red. Is that good? Can you hear me, ma'am? Okay.
We can. If the staff can't hear, let us know, but we can hear you well.
Thank you, ma'am. Chairwoman Slotkin, Ranking Member Pfluger, and members of the subcommittee, good morning. Thank you for inviting me here today to testify on how cryptocurrencies, virtual currencies, and other forms of digital money are being used to further advance criminal activity, including acts of terrorism and violent extremism. My name is Jeremy Sheridan, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Secret Service's Office of Investigations. I lead our more than 160 field offices and direct our global network of cyber fraud task forces. I work to ensure that the Secret Service is effectively detecting and arresting those engaged in the violations we are authorized to investigate, while also supporting our diverse protective requirements across the world. For more than 150 years, the Secret Service has conducted investigations to protect the American public, private companies, financial institutions, and critical infrastructure from criminal exploitation. We maintain extensive authorities, expertise, and capabilities to safeguard financial and payment systems from criminal misuse, even as those activities are increasingly transnational and enabled by digital money. The Secret Service has a distinctive record of success in countering risks related to new technologies. We have successfully investigated and dismantled some of the most notorious virtual money platforms and crypto exchanges and brought to justice some of the most infamous money launderers and cyber criminals in U.S. history. Today, we remain committed to keeping pace with innovation and the evolving strategies and tactics criminals are using to exploit new financial instruments. Our perspective on these matters is based on our unique role. We are not a financial regulator or a member of the intelligence community. We are a law enforcement agency focused on accomplishing our integrated mission of protecting designated persons, places, and events, and investigating crimes that undermine the integrity of financial and payment systems. This unified mission necessitates that we understand how digital money may present risks to the nation's financial system, as well as to our many protectees. Consequently, today I will aim to address the broad criminal risks of digital money, as well as the work of the Secret Service and our partners to mitigate those risks. I believe the measures to investigate and address these risks apply equally to violent extremism and financially motivated crime as they do to other forms of criminality. I wish to stress that while digital money is not inherently criminal, it can be abused and is currently being abused for a wide variety of criminal purposes, from money laundering and ransomware to illicit financing of terrorism and violent extremism. Over the past decade, law enforcement has made great strides in the fight against the illicit use of digital money, but we anticipate that the ongoing growth in criminality will continue over the coming years. Organized crime groups, terrorists, and other bad actors will continue to view digital money as an effective means to transfer value globally and as a means of evading the anti-money laundering controls that are well established within the traditional financial system. As the cryptocurrency industry improves their compliance with anti-money laundering obligations, the Secret Service is focused on staying one step ahead of our adversaries. By building the investigative capabilities and purview to meet the evolving threats, we can continue to detect and arrest those who engage in criminality using digital money. But we must not be complacent. Keeping pace with criminals requires a continuous investment in technology, training, and most importantly, people. The investigation of cybercrime and illicit finance is complex, demanding work. We need a steady stream of bright, diligent professionals equipped with the latest technology, training, and expertise if we hope to continue to be successful in the future as we have in the past. Allow me to reiterate what many of my predecessors have emphasized. Those that seek to further their illicit activities through the use of digital currencies or the internet more broadly should have no illusions that they are beyond the reach of law. Even those digital assets and services that claim to be anonymous can be tracked and interdicted. As the investigative work of the Secret Service and our partners has demonstrated over the decades, we in law enforcement, whether it be the Secret Service, the FBI, HSI, IRS-CI, or any of the other investigative agencies of the U.S. government, are relentless in enforcing the law. We will not stop until those who seek to harm the United States and its citizens are arrested, convicted, and punished. Chairwoman Slotkin, Ranking Member Pfluger, and members of the subcommittee, thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you today and for your continued support of the U.S. Secret Service. I look forward to working closely with this committee and with other members of Congress on our shared priorities and welcome your questions.
I thank all the witnesses for their testimony. I will remind the subcommittee that we each have 5 minutes to question the panel. Since we haven't been in the room for a while, the clock is under the screens, and that is 5 minutes total. So I'll give you a gentle tap of the gavel when you've hit your 5 minute mark if you're going strong. I'll now recognize myself for questions. So, Ms. Dobish, can you help us just contextualize the threat? You know, sort of, we know that there is, there's a bunch of terrorist organizations. There's a bunch of domestic extremist organizations that threaten Americans in different ways. How significant is the use of cryptocurrency versus other types of currencies, versus traditional types of currencies? I know it's hard to put an exact percentage on it, but give us a sense of the scale, if you would.
Thank you, Chairwoman. In terms of the scale, I think from a terrorist perspective, we're really in the nascent stages, particularly as we look at foreign terrorist groups overseas. They remain reliant on those traditional sources of funding, but we are seeing increasing use of cryptocurrency, particularly regarding soliciting donations and fundraising. So early on in the stages, I think from a criminal perspective, it's becoming more mainstream. Obviously, we're seeing more activity from transnational criminal organizations, obviously from cyber criminals, and in certain instances, nation states that are using it more frequently than they are those traditional sources. I think as the technology becomes more accessible and easier for the user, it's going to be more common among terrorist groups. Again, it's largely limited. We've seen several cases, but again, I think the concern for us is that as the technology advances and becomes more user-friendly, that we're going to see more activity.
And Mr. Isert, can you help us understand the use of sites that Americans are really used to, like GoFundMe, Amazon, to raise money for charity? You know, most Americans have seen someone at least advertise those kinds of campaigns. Can you talk to us about what, if any, abuse you see of those sites?
Sure. Luckily for us, a lot of those mainstream payment systems like PayPal and GoFundMe, they have due diligence systems in place and checks and balances. So a lot of the social media sites and those mainline payment systems have identified criminal activity and have pushed them off the networks. But that's why, that is one of the reasons why we're starting to see an increase into these alternate forms of payment systems like virtual currency.
And then I think for both Mr. Isert and Mr. Sheridan, just tell us about, you know, I assume that from a law enforcement perspective, it's just harder to go after, you know, groups that are using cryptocurrency as opposed to traditional currencies. What are the tools or legal authorities that are either you don't have, that you want to have, that would make your life easier? What are the roadblocks that are holding you back?
That's a really important question, ma'am. Thank you. So in regards to your first question about tools, we in the Secret Service rely on our cyber fraud task forces that are stationed globally and partner with all of government in order to combat this threat. What we need in order to expand is to increase our presence in the international setting. As was mentioned earlier, this is an international, transnational crime situation that we're facing, and we need to increase our presence there. We need to get better at our processes in order to ensure that we're aggregating data appropriately and conducting the necessary data link analysis for attribution, and we need to continue to modernize. We greatly appreciate Congress's help in the Cyber Fraud Task Force modernization that they have assisted us with, but we need to continue to grow in those areas. As it relates to authorities, similarly, ma'am, there are areas for growth as it relates to our investigative authorities related to money laundering, structured payments, and unlicensed money transmitters that would make us stronger in this fight.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'd love to hear more about some of the details. And then to Ms. Dobish again, you know, we know that intelligence is an important part of understanding these organizations and how they finance themselves. Talk to us about, like, what does the interagency structure look like in the government? Who's working on this? Who do you talk to every day? Is there actually coordination between different actors?
Yes, ma'am, it's certainly an interagency problem. And I think the difficulty really is thinking about that end user. So we're seeing the activity occurring, but oftentimes we have significant information and intelligence gaps about where that money is going and how it's ultimately used. INA certainly serves as that bridge between law enforcement and the intelligence community. And in addition to that, it really takes not just an individual or an intelligence officer that kind of understands the intent and capabilities of the actor, but also has that deep understanding and knowledge of the technology itself. If you look at a group like ISIS, in terms of their use of drones, really since 2014, they rapidly expanded their capability to leverage drones first for reconnaissance and then for actual attacks on the battlefield overseas. And so it really takes a whole of government effort and connecting that law enforcement information with the intelligence to get the fullest picture of the threat.
Great. I now recognize Ranking Member Mr. Pfluger for questions.
Thank you, Chairwoman. And I'm so glad you brought up the use of drones. I think it is the key here is that they are using an innovative approach, and the nature of warfare is constantly changing, and we have to stay one step ahead. And so I appreciate your testimonies so far, and wanted to get right into some questions on Mr. Isert. Understanding that cryptocurrencies attract bad actors because of the pseudo anonymity or anonymity in some cases and ease of transfer, I want to focus now on the cartels. Have you seen cartels using cryptocurrencies in order to hide illicit proceeds from transnational criminal activity?
Yes, thank you for that question. We do have recent investigations where we do see cartels conducting business with money brokers, professional money launderers. And throughout our investigations, we target these professional money launderers and insert our undercover activity with them. Specific to the cartels, we've found ourselves in the middle of investigations picking up cartel-level street proceeds and converting them to cryptocurrency through peer-to-peer platforms.
How easy is that for them to translate that into to either leverage for what they want to get out of it, for the use of, into and out of the United States?
Well, once it's in the virtual currency format, it could be moved around the world in a matter of minutes, 100 times over around the world. The biggest choke point and where we have our most success is when the on-ramping or the off-ramping of that virtual currency. So, for instance, getting it into the virtual currency realm. And that's where we have our success in our undercover platforms and through our traditional money laundering investigations. A few years back, many of the mainline exchanges were regulated as money service businesses and needed know-your-customer regulations, and that has pushed a lot of the illicit activity to unregulated peer-to-peer atmosphere, and that's where we primarily target the cartel and their work.
Thank you very much for that. For Mr. Sheridan, how does the Secret Service's approach differ from other agencies, other law enforcement colleagues, and what kind of what makes you and the Secret Service unique in this regard?
Thank you for that question, sir. So all law enforcement entities bring their own unique set of capabilities to this fight. We in the Secret Service are a smaller organization. That makes us more agile for information sharing and case coordination within our own agency. That small size also requires us to rely on partnerships. Partnerships are the lifeblood of the Secret Service, not only in our protective mission, but investigatively as well. So we develop very strong partnerships across all of government and with our international law enforcement partners. We also have a unique methodology in that we've been doing this for 150 years. We have, over the past several decades, created a database of information related to these cyber actors, many of whom have graduated up to these most complex cyber-enabled fraud schemes that we're seeing today. And we're able to follow that digital link to when they were just starting out and had a more public and weren't as concerned with their online presence as being so noticeable. And then I think our perspective is based on our focused statutory authority, which is to protect the nation's financial payment systems and financial infrastructure. That allows us to be specialist as opposed to generalist and create really subject matter experts within our organization to conduct these investigations.
Thank you for that. And let me just talk about the whole of government approach, and I appreciate your comments on that, Ms. Dobich. For me, representing a university that is a cyber center of excellence, talk to me about that whole of government approach, the private, public partnerships that you all, I think, have mentioned, and how we can leverage a university like Angelo State University, who focuses on this, and by the way, a minority-serving institution, a Hispanic-serving institution, doing wonderful things. Talk to me about how we can incorporate students in their learning and what they should be focusing on so that they can enter your organizations and combat this.
Yes, sir, absolutely. As I stated earlier, having a sophisticated understanding of the technology itself is the first step, and that often comes from private business and academia. Understanding the trends that exist in cryptocurrency and other digital currencies is really that first step. And then also learning more about the vulnerabilities of each of those types of currencies. From the classified intelligence perspective, we have the intent and capabilities of those actors, but we can only understand really what the threat is if we know well what the technology is able to do and what security mechanisms are in place to prevent the malicious use of that currency or other technology. So it really is a partnership. It's not just intelligence. That's why we say information and intelligence. It's that law enforcement data. It's the private academia and really all sources of information, because this is a global trend. It's a global technology, and all types of actors are really seeking to exploit the technology for their own benefit.
Well, thank you for that. And we need to know the resources that you need. We need to know the things that you identify, what we're talking about here, and if there's more comprehensive lists, we need to know that. We've seen it in the ransomware attacks recently. You have mentioned it in many of the examples you've given us, but that's the purpose of this hearing, and the purpose of our committee is to give you those resources, if we can, to make sure that we can combat that. With that, Madam Chair, I yield back.
The chair will now recognize other members for questions they may wish to ask the witnesses. In accordance with the guidelines laid out by the chairman and ranking member in the February 3rd colloquy, I will recognize members in order of seniority, alternating between majority and minority. Members participating virtually are also reminded to unmute themselves when recognized for questioning. The chair recognizes for 5 minutes the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Malinowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, as all of you have testified, cryptocurrencies are being used right now for all kinds of very nefarious purposes, to purchase illicit goods, drugs, and guns, to provide material support to terrorist organizations, to enable the ransom payments that are fueling arguably the biggest threat, one of the biggest threats that Americans are facing in their daily lives today. Mr. Izard, I think you said in your testimony that they give bad actors the ability to engage in money laundering with minimal effort. It's pretty bad. Just so everybody is clear, maybe say a little bit more about that. What is it about cryptocurrency that enables you, somebody, to engage in money laundering with minimal effort?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. The cryptocurrency problem set transcends borders, transcends industries. And what I mean by that is, as I discussed earlier, once you can get your money into the crypto world through a regulated exchanger or an unregulated exchanger, it's a push of the button. I could tell you about the old days of law enforcement, of following money launderers from bank to bank, and good luck if they could hit 20 in a day. Now you can sit on your couch and move it 100 times over. There's one documented case where money was moved over 24,000 times before it came out. Yeah. It's that simple. So once it's in the system, it's moving. Tracing it within the system, it's challenging, but not unbelievable. And it's identifying who that is attached to that transaction is the challenge.
Well, here's what troubles me, and Chairwoman Slotkin, in her opening statement, said that there's nothing inherently wrong with digital currency, and I could be convinced of that, but I'm not convinced of that because I'm trying to see the other side. With, for example, drone technology, we know drones can be used for deadly, nefarious purposes, including some we have not yet seen, but we all fear. And yet all of us can list dozens of positive uses of drone technology for consumers, for companies. Maybe this, you're not the right people to ask this question to, but can you think of any socially beneficial uses of cryptocurrency beyond providing some people with something to speculate in and make money off of?
Well, coming from the law enforcement side, we're always looking at the illicit side. So I can only tell you what my beliefs are and what's out there on the open web. I believe a lot of that focus goes into the underbanked. It gives an opportunity for the underbanked areas and countries to engage in worldwide transactions.
I don't know. I hear things like, well, it provides privacy. That didn't stop us from... and I'm deeply committed to privacy. It did not stop us from banning the use of anonymous shell companies for very similar reasons, right? Because they're used to cover up illicit activity. I hear the phrase that it enables the democratization of currency. And every time someone says we're democratizing something, it kind of ends the conversation. That's sort of good. I don't really understand what that means. In this context, I think it's an abstraction, whereas ransomware attacks are not an abstraction. They're hurting people every single day. So I'm not sure if I see it, and I think we do need to expand this conversation to ask that fundamental question, whether the challenges that you are facing, that we are asking you to deal with in protecting us against all of these social ills, are challenges that are necessary, inescapable, and inevitable. And I think we have to ask, what is the good? What is the positive social value of this phenomenon that is also creating all of this harm? And, you know, I think when you look at the history of how we built modern economies in the United States and around the world, we started 300 or 400 years ago with multiple currencies that were unregulated and not controlled by governments. And in every modern economy, we built what we have today when government decided, no, we're going to have one currency that is issued and regulated by government. And I think I could ask you, we don't have time, how we can better regulate cryptocurrency. But I think if we regulated it, it wouldn't be crypto anymore. And so what would be the point? So I come back to the question, should this be allowed? Thank you. I yield back.
The chair recognizes for 5 minutes the gentleman from Mississippi, Mr. Guest.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director Sheridan, you say in your written testimony that for cryptocurrency and other digital assets to be utilized within the mainstream economy, they usually must be converted into government-backed currency, such as the U.S. dollar and the euro. You say that exchanges serve both as on-ramps and off-ramps to the cryptocurrency economy. You talk about the growth of unlicensed over-the-counter brokers and the importance of anti-money laundering and know your customers' laws. Could you expand on that very briefly?
Yes, sir. Thank you for that question. What my written testimony was meant to encapsulate is the ecosystem of what we refer to as digital money. We see in a lot of these conversations that the terms related to the different platforms are used interchangeably. Virtual currency, digital currency, cryptocurrency. We in the Secret Service use the term digital money because that encapsulates all forms to include cryptocurrency and the most commonly referred to coins such as Bitcoin, Ethereum, Tether, and so forth. The true definition really comes down to the technology used to create it, the regulations that apply, whether or not it's legal tender. But for us, it comes down to how it's used. And so the written testimony is meant to describe in more detail how it's used, as my colleague has identified, to on-ramp from legal tender to digital money, how it's used laterally for legal and illicit means, and how it's off-ramped, converted away from a digital platform to legal tender. The exchanges that were referenced are certainly integral to that, and these are the ways in which we in law enforcement find our primary means to engage it for identification and further information related to the digital money that's used.
And switching gears very quickly, back in April, there was an announcement that the Secret Service was going to partner with the Mississippi Attorney General's Office, various other local law enforcement agencies, and establishing a Mississippi fraud task force, cyber fraud task force. My question is twofold. One, can you talk a little bit about the importance of these task force, how that serves as a force multiplier to what you are trying to do in the Secret Service? And then the other thing I want to follow up on is my understanding that all of these agents will be trained at the National Computer Forensic Institute, which is located at Hoover, Alabama. I'm very familiar with that institute. But can you talk a little bit about the mission of that institute and the important role that organization serves?
Yes, sir. The cyber fraud task forces are our global network of investigative task force staffed by not only our special agent personnel, but our professional workforce of subject matter experts from our investigative services division, our network intrusion financial or forensic analysts. These are our touch points to the local communities, to your constituents that bring the information back to our Global Investigation Operations Center to make the whole Secret Service approach to our investigations. As you said, sir, a lot of what we do on that local level is through the National Computer Forensics Institute. As you're aware, that is the only federal facility to train and equip state, local, territorial, tribal officers, judges, and prosecutors. And those officers and law enforcement entities are really the first responders. They're the front line. They're the surge capacity in this fight against the complex cyber-enabled fraud. We are very grateful for the support of Congress for the growth of that facility. We've trained over 16,000 of those law enforcement officials. But as you're aware, that facility's authorization is due to sunset in 2022, and we would greatly appreciate the support to continue its authorization, not only domestically, but to expand that same training to our foreign partners to take this fight globally, to have that surge capacity on a global scale.
And as it relates to the National Computer Forensic Institute, do you feel that it serves as a key component in our fight against cybercrime?
Sir, I could not agree with you more wholeheartedly on that question. It trains, equips state, local officers to be the first line of defense, the first people that your constituents are primarily going to call. And with their support, as I mentioned, partnerships in the Secret Service and shoulder to shoulder with us, this is how we're going to beat this adversary and how we're going to get more competent at combating these types of fraud schemes.
And as I understand your testimony, Director Sheridan, you believe it is crucial that Congress not only reauthorize this program, but that we robustly fund what is going on there at the National Computer Forensic Institute. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I think that's imperative in this fight.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I yield back.
Perfect timing. The chair recognizes for 5 minutes the gentleman from California, Mr. Swalwell.
Thank you, and I thank the chairwoman for holding this critical hearing as the dashboard is blinking for America's businesses as it relates to ransomware attacks. In many ways, this feels like a pre-September 11 environment for businesses in that you have all the signs there that you know, we are going to continue to face attacks, perhaps ones that could shut down for a protracted period of time critical infrastructure. You have these attacks being launched from foreign countries that are not our allies. It's unclear whether they are state-sponsored, but they're certainly state-enabled because countries are looking the other way and aren't cooperating with us or Interpol in apprehending and stopping the hackers. And so I wanted to first invoke a Bay Area business leader, John Chambers, who used to be the CEO at Cisco. He recently said that more than 65,000 ransomware attacks are expected to happen this year at an average cost to small and medium-sized businesses of $170,000 each. Kevin Mandia, the CEO of FireEye, recently said there's a direct correlation between ransomware and the anonymity of digital currency. And while I certainly am a supporter of cryptocurrency and blockchain technologies, I want to make sure that they are not contributing to or enabling these attacks. And so the question I have first is, anonymous cryptocurrency hindering your office's abilities at DHS to respond to cyber attacks? Mr. Isert, to you.
Thank you for that question. And to get to your point about the use of virtual currencies in ransomware, the biggest hurdle is already taken care of with those illicit actors. The payer is on-ramping that money into the system for them, and that's usually where we have our greatest success, as I discussed before. As for the fight against network intrusion, the HSI has a cyber crime center, which supports cyber-enabled crimes as well as cybercrime directly. And within the cybercrime center, we have a network intrusion program. We call it Operation Cyber Centurion. And what Cyber Centurion does is we have trained special agents around the country with specific software and tools. And we scan and detect vulnerabilities in the infrastructure. So we'll scan the open net for vulnerabilities that have been published by our sister agency, CISA. When we identify those vulnerabilities, we'll reach out to those organizations and say, hey, you have a gap here, or hey, you have a gap and someone's inside your system right now. And then we'll proactively do an investigation with that.
Thank you, Mr. Isert. To follow up on that, how much does it help when a business reports to you that they have been attacked? And how does that factor into whether you think we should have mandatory reporting, whether it's in critical infrastructure space or just business-wide in America? What information do you yield when you learn about a ransomware attack?
The more dots we have out there, the more connections we can make. So that with the increased reporting, either it be from the financial arena, just in the trend of money laundering and everything else, or private industry on how they've been hacked. When we have more bits of evidence and information, we could connect to bigger networks. So it would be extreme help to have that information.
I know there's a lot that we can do, you know, left of boom as far as like the hygiene requirements that we have, particularly of, you know, United States government, you know, vendors and contractors. But on the right of boom side, what are you doing to make sure that businesses are comfortable working with DHS or the Bureau? And, you know, the concern I've heard from some vendors is, you know, we don't want to open our books up to the FBI or DHS. You know, who knows, you know, what we've done inadvertently that could put us, you know, on their radar. And we don't want them thinking that way. We want them to trust the government, that the government can be a part of understanding the attack and ideally have the capability to shut it down. So what are you doing to try and earn the trust of businesses who are victims?
Again, thank you for that question. Well, we partner tremendously with our brothers and sisters and FBI and CISA in this world. We do a lot of outreach. I spoke earlier about Operation Cornerstone, which does a lot of outreach to private industries to let them know who we are, what we can do, how we can help. And with that comes a level of comfortability. I can't speak for the other agencies on what they do independently, but I think it's important that we continue to work together and show that we're in this with one fight.
Great. Thank you. And thank the chair for the hearing.
Thank you. The chair recognizes for 5 minutes the gentleman from the greatest state in the union, Michigan, Mr. Meyer.
Amen. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to our witnesses for testifying here today and sharing a little bit more of your knowledge and experience and understanding on this critical issue that has obviously been in the news because of ransomware, but has been an issue more broadly. As ranking member of this committee's oversight subcommittee, I always want to make sure that our government is functioning as efficiently and as adequately as possible, so that we can be most effective in combating terrorism. You know, we have before us three different subcomponents of the Department of Homeland Security represented, and so I will allow whoever feels most well-equipped to answer this question to do so. But I want to understand, with all of the different federal government entities engaged in countering terrorism financing and the illicit financial activities that help contribute towards it, can you provide a little bit more clarity on which specific agencies are responsible for tracking which activities? So what are the left and right limits, not only of your own agencies, but also how you, or entities, but also how you engage with the broader intelligence and law enforcement community in these efforts?
Sir, if I could, I'll start conceptually first. Mm-hmm. We do recognize the fact that there are certainly overlapping authorities to some extent and responsibilities, but we in law enforcement view it as a team sport. There's more than enough work to go around, and it's essential that we have that level of partnership and collaboration due to the complexity and the scope and scale of our adversary. We have institutional deconfliction and information sharing mechanisms in place to ensure we aren't being wasteful in any way and being good stewards of the American taxpayer dollar, to your concern. More on a tactical approach, I will speak for the Secret Service in that our role is focused on protecting the nation's financial infrastructure and financial payment systems. So we will investigate crimes that violate U.S. law related to those. And because of those information sharing mechanisms we have in place through our task forces, with my colleagues here at the table, as well as all of federal and state local law enforcement, we're able to share information and case coordination as an investigation comes up that may not focus on those payment systems.
If I may add to that, primacy within the Joint Terrorism Task Force lays with the FBI. So they'll always have primacy when it comes to terrorism financing. But like my colleague said, a lot of us bring unique authorities to the table. HSI is the largest federal contributor to the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. And it speaks specifically about those authorities. 50%, almost 50% of all disruptions within the Joint Terrorism Task Force falls within the authorities that HSI brings to the table. So, for instance, the UC activity, the undercover activity that we have, full use of Bank Secrecy Act data that we have, full access to trade data. So each agency is bringing their particular skill set.
And I'll just add as well, I think from the intelligence perspective, INA is really serving as the bridge between the intelligence community and our state and local law enforcement partners. And the first step really is access to that data, making sure that everyone involved in this fight has access to that data and that it's integrated in a way that we could use technology to quickly identify those threats. We think it's critical, particularly as we talked about how big cryptocurrency is and the use of digital currencies. It requires a sophisticated understanding and expertise, but technology to be able to quickly comb through the data and figure out what we should be looking at. So it's really the access and the integration that's critical. And oftentimes we have local law enforcement information that's filling intelligence gaps and intelligence information that's helping local law enforcement understand what those vulnerabilities are.
Thank you all for your responses to that, to better help kind of flesh out that that universe from a top-down level. And I'm heartened to hear on both the access side and the information sharing side and on the deconfliction mechanism side that those have been adequately addressed. I guess when it comes to resources and capabilities, and my time is running short here, but are there any concerns that there may be either gaps in enforcement, gaps in collection, or gaps in capabilities that we should be working to address?
Specific to the virtual currency problem set, the current regulations doesn't encapsulate the whole virtual currency. AML and know your customer stuff does not mirror traditional banking industry AML.
And then with that, Madam Chair, my time has expired. Now yield back.
Thank you. I'll just note for the members that we'll do a quick second round here. But the chair recognizes for 5 minutes the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Gottheimer.
Thank you, Chairwoman Slotkin, for organizing this very important hearing. And thank you to each of the witnesses for being here today and for the work you and your colleagues do to help counter the illicit use of cryptocurrencies. I am concerned about the increasing attractiveness of cryptocurrencies to two types of illicit actors. One, foreign terrorist organizations such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and ISIS. And secondly, to the use of domestic white supremacists like the Proud Boys and other violent extremist groups, which were involved in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. If it's okay, I will start with you, Ms. Dobich. How does our ability to pursue the illicit use of cryptocurrencies differ between these two types of actors? Is it easier to shut down, seize the assets of, and bring charges against foreign terrorist organizations compared to domestic violent extremists?
Thank you, sir. I would say that it's complex from both perspectives, in part because of the anonymity that cryptocurrency and other digital currencies provide. Even if we can see the transaction, we often don't know who the transaction or who is receiving that, and then what the ultimate purpose of that that resource is. So it's difficult, even from a foreign terrorist perspective, to be able to track that money as it relates to it ultimately resulting in the purchase of a weapon or some kind of facilitation of an operation. From the domestic violent extremist angle, certainly we are seeing an increase in calls for fundraising and donations using cryptocurrency, but we have a difficult time really trying to translate that to violence and understanding how that resource is being translated into a plot or an operation here in the homeland.
Thank you. But compared to cash, is it easier to track, or it's still more difficult because you can't really understand the purpose of it?
I would defer to my law enforcement colleagues on which one is
I guess
more
I'll,
or less.
I guess I'll turn to Mr. Isert on that one. Or Mr. Sheridan, I guess. I don't know who do you think is better on that one?
Is your question about,
I guess it's a Secret Service question, so cash.
Is your question about tracking, sir?
Yeah.
By its nature, digital money is easier to track because there is a digital trail and actual evidence related to its use and each step it takes along the blockchain as it moves.
If I can stick with you, if that's okay, how can we eliminate barriers and friction for law enforcement to make it easier for us to keep up with ever-evolving digital assets and technologies? Is there anything you think we should be doing straight away?
For us, it would be resourcing in the basic concepts of people, process, and technology. We need to increase our workforce, not only in volume, but in capabilities on the law enforcement side, as well as the subject matter experts, our professional work staff that we hire. We have a great team of computer scientists, folks with the capabilities to conduct blockchain analysis and crypto tracing, but we need more of them. We need to keep pace with the adversary. We need to grow into the international locations where we don't have as strong a presence because this is a transnational crime. We need to get better at our processes to modernize and have more advanced capabilities to handle the volume of data that we're seeing because there is such a significant trading and movement related to these currencies. And we also need to modernize our technologies related to our task forces throughout the globe.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Isert, would you describe the role undercover HSI agents played in last year's seizure of millions of dollars in cryptocurrencies from terrorists, including ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Hamas, if you don't mind? Thanks.
Absolutely. Excuse me, though, if I stay vague. There's a lot of undercover activity and classified information that we're happy to host a separate meeting on.
Of course.
But those initial leads, if I can just bulk them together, they ran parallel and were very similar. Those initial leads came through the Intelligence Committee, as well as some reporting from watchdog organizations. Upon identifying the illicit intent of those organizations, we approached each of those organizations with multiple undercover personas, engaged them in conversation to get the intent of what the purpose of the money was, at which point we started to identify the Bitcoin wallets that they asked for. And throughout the investigation, the methods changed, but with each method change, we just identified a new branch of tracing that we had to run and go do, bringing it right to the end, bringing it right to the culmination of the seizure of about $10 million in both cases.
Excellent. I appreciate that, and I would enjoy a briefing in a classified setting on that.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, and I yield back. Thank you, Charlman.
Thank you. We'll now turn to a second round. I'll recognize myself for some questions. So two very different questions. One is on this idea that our companies, our organizations, even local governments are not mandated reporters when it comes to the attacks that they withstand. So, for instance, a big box store could be hacked and have a ton of all of our personal data taken and then pay a ransom for that money, potentially through cryptocurrency, and not have to report that to the very individuals who had their information stolen. Not have to report that to law enforcement, not have to actually say anything. And we've seen examples of companies who have waited 6 months, a year, et cetera, to actually come forward and say something about this. Tell me, for the folks in law enforcement, what that does to your ability to actually help go after these guys. Do you believe that companies should be mandated report, companies and organizations should be mandated reporters when they are the victim of a hacking or ransomware attack? Mr. Sheridan.
Thank you, ma'am. That's an extremely important question. We, yes, support reporting in all instances to law enforcement, regardless of agency or which law enforcement entity it is reported to. I do believe there's some misconceptions about law enforcement's role in this, as was referenced earlier, that perhaps law enforcement creates an intrusion or creates some type of vulnerability to systems. We view our investigative mission as part of the prevention process. We will work with organizations and whatever third party they have as part of their security team in a collaborative sense. Reporting to us will help make systems stronger, will help identify areas of weakness, the attack vectors, the indicators of compromise that will prevent future attacks, not only to that individual organization, but perhaps other organizations that may have similar vulnerabilities.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess, you know, I talk to people in my district and they feel like their data, their information, they are on the front lines of kind of a cyber war. And they're asking me constantly, you know, are we doing something about this? Is my government helping to stop these attacks? And a lot of people took notice when the Colonial Pipeline was attacked and ransomed, when we were, you know, we got money back through the FBI acting to grab some of that money back. It felt like the first time we were punching back in a public way, right? Of course, there's lots of things I know you can't talk about, and we're glad to not talk about them. But help explain to, again, that farmer in the middle of my district who's asking about cybersecurity, convince him that their government is doing something about the fact that they're being constantly attacked.
Yes, ma'am. Well, it starts, as was referenced earlier, with the National Computer Forensics Institute. We have trained over 16,000 state, local officers to be the first responders to these events. It starts with contacting them, contacting law enforcement. There are multiple tools within our organizations and our partners in order to interdict and stop in real time some of these victimizations that are occurring, not only within the network itself, but in terms of the transfer of the funds that have been taken by these illicit actors. Within the Secret Service, we have our global rapid response and incident tracking team that is able to domestically stop wire transfers if notified within a certain amount of time and since inception in 2000.
If notified.
Mm-hmm. If notified.
Right.
If it's notified, since 2019, we've intercepted more than $80 million in transit to prevent it to going from illicit actors. Within the Department of Treasury, the FinCEN has their rapid response program. Similarly, that's more internationally focused. But over the past 4 years, we have an 82% success rate working with FinCEN. If notified within a 72-hour window, primarily within a 48-hour window, the success rate drops dramatically, depending on the amount of time has lapsed. But we've been able to interdict more than $385 million from going to criminal actors. Within the Secret Service, we have our own asset forfeiture branch that returns victim funds to victims if we're notified, if we're able to participate in the investigation, and find the illicit funds in transit.
So that's super helpful and connects the two questions, right? That you all can actually do some real things if you're notified. But our current system does not require organizations or companies to notify anybody if their data has been taken, if there've been has been ransomed. So I appreciate that and would offer that we could do with a little bit more public talk and discussion from you all about what you're doing, because it sounds like it's more than the average citizen knows, and they want to know that their government is protecting them. So with that, I yield to the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Pfluger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of discussing a similar topic, you know, attribution seems to be one of the toughest things to get after. And so whether it's mandatory or whether this public-private partnership encourages people because they know that if the assets that they have potentially lost are going to be returned to them, then hopefully that will also drive a motivation to report. And especially if the education is out there, we have forums where they understand that, you know, your agencies offer them something to prevent, this type of activity from happening. But let me kind of focus in on the National Computer Forensics, Institute and why it's valuable, to the Secret Service, in your investigations and what more, it can be doing and how can we in Congress support you, Mr. Sheridan?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. We are very, very grateful for Congress's support to this date regarding NCFI. It's been phenomenal to see the growth in that program and what the number of people and state, local officers, judges, and prosecutors that have been trained there, over 16,000 to date. We're currently training about 3,000 a year. Projected estimates are almost twice that, but we're limited by not only the authorization that's pending in 22 to sunset, but the current resourcing that we have to that facility. We think we can double our capacity in terms of training, as well as expand into international areas, which I think is imperative for us to be stronger globally with our law enforcement partners around the world in order to combat this.
Well, thank you. And just a question for any of you that wants to comment on this. How closely linked are terrorist organizations and these ransomware attacks that we are seeing, which are not new, but some of them are being publicized, especially the ones that are happening towards critical infrastructure, whether it's our food supply or energy supply? How closely linked, and what is the projected or estimated threat in, as you see it with your crystal ball in the future?
So to date, we haven't seen really any connections between ransomware attacks and terrorist groups or associates. But what we would underscore is, as we discussed earlier, that rapid ability to adapt that we've seen demonstrated by the broad range of terrorist groups. In addition to that, we call it the copycat trend. Terrorist groups often adopt tactics, techniques, and procedures from other malicious actors that they see as beneficial to them. And so, again, as terrorists' use of cryptocurrency and digital currencies becomes more commonplace, certainly we could expect to see them using ransomware as a means to fund their operations. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we're increasingly seeing cyber criminals offer ransomware as a service. So individuals can buy a service on the dark web, and we often don't know who the actor is that's paying for that service. So there are many opportunities for terrorists to exploit ransomware to support their operations.
Again, probably underscoring the NCFI, your role that you play there. And I would just say, based on that response, that I don't think our position on this has to be incredibly strong. The responses that we, as a country, levy upon bad actors, criminal organizations, terrorist organizations, malign actors anywhere, state or non-state, it's not limited to 16 industries in this country. It's going to be across the board, and our response has got to be strong. And I hope that this committee will continue to take that up and investigate this. With that, Madam Chair, I'll yield back.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Malinowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still not convinced this market in cryptocurrency should even exist, but let's talk about regulation for a moment. The Treasury Department recently announced that it would be requiring cryptocurrency transactions, I believe, over $10,000 to be reported to the IRS. Is that correct?
I believe this proposed legislation.
It's proposed, right. So that does require action from us, or is this something that...
I'd have to defer to Treasury on that.
Okay. In principle, would that at least help to address the challenge that Chairwoman Slotkin referred to, in the sense that presumably a company making a ransom payment of over $10,000 would then at least have to report that to the IRS?
I would say... depending on how the regulation's written. If we want to take mainstream financial institutions and how regulations are written now, if cash was to go into the system, there would be a requirement. Right now, the mainstream regulation revolves around cash.
Okay.
And if it mirrored it with virtual currency, then yes.
And that would presumably be helpful to you all. Yes. Okay. And most ransomware payments would be over $10,000 just in the current scheme of things. Yes. So it would probably capture a significant share, if not all, ransomware payments. Other ideas. Should the SEC be given the authority to regulate cryptocurrency exchanges? And is that something that the administration is considering proposing?
So, sir, the challenge with regulation that we see is because digital money is used in so many different capacities, depending on the technology it's used to create it and essentially how it is employed, there's no one regulatory agency that currently has oversight. Sometimes it's a commodity, sometimes it's a security, a derivative, legal tender. So regulation is certainly important. As my colleague has identified, the anti-money laundering laws, Know Your Customer, countering of financing of terrorism, the anti-money laundering law of 2020 have all been instrumental in helping tamp down criminal activity related to this. But from a law enforcement perspective, we are not regulatory in nature, and our perspective would be to grow authorities related to our investigative and statutory capabilities as opposed to regulatory capabilities. There is some concern, as also was referenced, about the dual-edged nature of overregulation that may push illicit use and criminal actors deeper into anonymizing methods and corners of the internet that would make it more difficult for law enforcement. Okay.
Well, we would very much value, I think, your guidance in finding that sweet spot. If the answer is going to be greater regulation, I presume that you would agree that whatever rules we come up with, they should be broadly harmonized across the 50 states, but also internationally. And I wonder if you know of any examples outside the United States of regulatory steps that, well, other governments, partner governments have taken that you think might be helpful to emulate or on the contrary, helpful not to emulate.
Sure, thank you. Homeland Security Investigations sits on working groups at the Financial Action Task Force, FATFs, which is a conglomerate of countries and regulatory bodies. In this working group, we discuss those exact things. Where should we be going? And many of the regulations you've seen proposed and had already come through are a result of those FATFs. With that, the regulations and Know Your Customer, they're meant to root out bad actors, support OFAC fundings. At no point do they restrict legal transfer of these virtual currencies. So it's important to note that no matter what's been proposed, nothing's restricting the use of virtual currency. It's just creating obtainable records to root out the bad actors.
Okay. Thank you. I yield back.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to follow up on the earlier line of questioning that I had. And Mr. Isert, I think you mentioned that one of the gaps that you identify when it comes to specific and virtual currency problem sets, and we've been talking about that a little bit. I want to drill down because I think many who are watching or listening here today are familiar with Bitcoin. They've at least heard of Bitcoin if they're not more broadly aware of blockchain and crypto. But Bitcoin, though it's the most well-known and one of the largest by market capitalization, is one of, I think, over 5,000 different cryptocurrencies. And so you have not only some others that people may have heard of, like Litecoin, Ethereum, Doge, but also many, many, many altcoins and then proposed stable coins as well. And Ms. Dobish, in your report, your testimony also said that newer and less popular cryptocurrencies are increasingly attractive to malicious actors because of their more stringent privacy and security features. I guess, how well-resourced do you feel to deal with the lesser-known cryptos, not just those who may be in the top, 5 or 10 of market cap, but even the potential for the exploitation of some of these mini or micro-cap cryptocurrencies?
The privacy coins create a challenge because of the hidden blockchain, obscured blockchain. A lot of our data analytics aren't as thorough as it is with the open blockchains. And sometimes it's not thorough enough for us to bring into a courtroom to do something. Luckily for us, because as you mentioned, the market cap and the total volume of coin, the usability is not there. If you're looking at Monero with maybe a market cap right now of 40 to 50 million, if you're looking to move 3 million in Monero, using 10% of the market. So the usability is not there yet, and that's the scary part. The good thing is a lot of U.S. exchanges will not accept Monero because of its hidden blockchain. It won't meet their Know Your Customer and AML policies.
Well, and I actually want to follow up on that point because, you know, we... You know, when terrorists were aware that there was that email traffic might be monitored. I mean, the way you get around that is you don't have that go through traffic, right? You have a draft, and then two parties both have access. I mean, what about a scenario where it is a super micro mini cap, where it's not usable as a currency, but if a company were to invest, you know, $10 million into it, and prior to that investment, a terrorist or ransomware entity, you know, buys up the entirety of it. I mean, it's essentially functioning as a mechanism to pass that through, because once the money's in there, they could just sell whatever the gains are, and then the, you know, all the losses are borne by the entity that had purchased that company paying that ransom. I mean, that would obviously be a scenario where, to Mr. Malinowski's reference to the proposed Treasury Department regulations, it would not qualify, because it isn't a transfer. It's merely a purchase that's held, but that asset, essentially like a balloon deflating, loses all value and all the air is captured on the outside. I mean, is that a scenario you could foresee happening?
Yeah, I'm trying to track most of it. Some of the regulations being proposed, and again, I really would prefer to yield to Treasury on something like that, is if an unhosted wallet has an exchange with a regulated wallet, there would be a reporting mechanism. So that would capture some of that. As for an altcoin or a privacy coin that an organization decides to use and pump a lot of money in, that's great. They're still going to have the problem of, I'm going to keep using the term, off-ramping it. And that's where the AML, the anti-money laundering policies, will take effect and capture.
Mr. Obisha, anything to add?
No, just that we have seen terrorist groups use privacy coins, including Monero. So it's certainly something that we're seeing. And I would also note that, you know, thousands of cryptocurrencies, the advancements are daily. So the increased privacy, the increased anonymity of these occurs with the creation of every new Bitcoin. So it's certainly a challenge, I think, first to understand what they're using and then to have greater insight into how they're actually using the currency.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the additional ability to probe a little bit deeper there. It's clearly that, you know, Bitcoin presents its own challenges, but in the broad, you know, ecosphere of various cryptocurrencies, especially when we get onto that very small end, the opportunities for exploitation are nearly limitless. And with that, Madam Chair, my time has expired, and I yield back.
With that, I thank the witnesses for their testimony and the members for their questions. The members of the subcommittee may have additional questions for the witnesses, and we ask that you respond expeditiously in writing to those questions. The chair reminds members that the subcommittee record will remain open for 10 business days. Without objection, the subcommittee stands adjourned.